5 countries that lost people in the Iran plane crash are meeting in London today, and they want answers.
The world is waiting for those answers, and we will not rest until we get them.
Also, Ukraine wades into the U.S. impeachment trial.
It's the first time that any Ukrainian state body, state institution, took initiative in the whole sorry saga.
And the toll from Australia's bushfires is coming into focus. Where homes used to stand, there's now silence.
There is smoke. The earth is still very hot. It's smoldering. It's black. It's ash. There are remains of what used to be a house, but there's nothing there.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us. Ukraine is at the center of President Trump's impeachment trial, which officially began today. But Kyiv has largely said that's an American issue. Until now, Ukraine's Ministry of Internal Affairs said today that it's opening a criminal probe of its own. It's going to investigate whether international laws were broken when allies of President Trump put the former American ambassador to Ukraine under surveillance. Newly released text messages and documents suggest this. The source, Lev Parnas, an associate of Rudy Giuliani. Parnas is a Soviet-born businessman and has been making the media rounds, saying the president of the United States knew what was going on. The BBC's Irina Taranyuk told me what Ukraine's criminal probe could look like.
Marco, the criminal probe looks perfectly justified because, according to the statement of Ukrainian Internal Home Office, a crime seems to be committed in Ukraine because it is a crime to have surveillance of diplomatic communications and also a violation of Vienna Convention on the Privacy Protection for Foreign Diplomats. So Ukraine's hand was forced, in a way, into opening this probe. But when you read the details of what it is that they opened, it becomes obvious that this criminal investigation or criminal probe is actually an appeal to the FBI in the United States to provide details, because as the statement from Ukrainian law enforcement says, it could be just bravado. It could be Mr. Hyde and Lev Parnas pretending to have more importance or knowing more than they actually did, that maybe there was no surveillance as such. So it's an appeal to the FBI, show us the cards that you've got, and then we will investigate further whether a crime indeed has taken place in Ukraine.
Right. Robert Hyde, he's allegedly the person who was doing the surveillance.
Exactly. But he couldn't do it without the help of some Ukrainian associates.
In an interview with Rachel Maddow on MSNBC last night, Lev Parnas said he actually did not take the view that Marie Yovanovitch was ever in danger when Robert Hyde was tracking her.
So it's clear that you didn't take Mr. Hyde seriously in terms of the factual claims that he was making. But are you clear on whether or not there was ever an actual physical threat or a threat of personal intimidation against Ambassador Yovanovitch?
Never from my side or anybody I know.
For Ukrainians, how reliable a voice is Parnas?
Until his arrest, Lev Parnas was virtually unknown in Ukraine. What he told Rachel Maddow about Masha Yovanovitch not being in any danger physically is true because, you know, she was the head of the diplomatic representation of the most powerful country in the world. And as such, she had diplomatic protection that was due her. Yet the fact that some people could brag about tracking her movements in Kyiv, being across the ocean, of course, is, I would imagine, a big cause for concern.
So Ukraine's been pulled into the middle of complicated U.S. domestic affairs, and with the Ukrainian plane catastrophe in Iran, it's become tragic at a global scale. So the fact that Ukraine is now part of these geopolitical tensions, how are people in Kyiv talking about that? What are you hearing?
Marco, and this is the biggest enigma of all, because Ukraine is very reluctant in being pulled into the spotlight. On the other hand, this tragedy, in the age of social media, you cannot stay away from the center stage, particularly if it's your plane that is being downed, particularly if you had problem neighbors like Russia claiming that you do not have the right to exist. Young and inexperienced, as he is mostly portrayed by Western and Ukrainian media alike, Ukrainian President Zelensky found himself between a rock and a hard place. It's the first time that any Ukrainian state body, state institution took initiative in the whole sorry saga of pressure on Ukraine over Biden's and the whole impeachment story in the United States. So politicians, Zelensky circle, deserve having better, deeper, more caring attention from the Washington, it would seem.
The BBC's Irena Taranyuk, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
That Ukrainian Airlines plane crash was the focus of high-level meetings in London today. Representatives of the five nations besides Iran, with citizens among the victims on the plane, were there. Ukraine, Sweden, Afghanistan, the UK, as well as Canada. Here's Canadian Foreign Minister François-Philippe Champagne.
Families want answers. All of the countries assembled here today want answers. And we will not rest until we get them.
The five nations made a number of demands on Iran. They want an independent, transparent investigation with full access for international investigators. They want to help identify the victims and want their remains to be repatriated to wherever requested by next of kin. Champagne added this.
The Iranian government has accepted full responsibility, but when you accept full responsibility, there's consequences coming from that. And that's what we're going to be pursuing.
The main consequence, he said, was accountability. He specifically said he expected to see prosecutions of those responsible and compensation to the families of victims. Champagne also added that the nations of the world had another responsibility.
Obviously, we want to get to the bottom of things, but also, as a world community, the world would like us to think about measures to prevent incidents like that from never happening again.
In Australia, finally some relief today. Rain.
Oh yeah! Woo!
A little hooting and hollering on the front porch of a home in Canberra as a steady downpour fell on the Australian capital. But that's after months of unprecedented heat and drought that have stoked massive bushfires. A little rain today has not ended that. The BBC's Shaima Halil is reporting from fire-ravaged communities across Australia. She spoke with the world's Carol Hills about being on the front lines of the fires.
Shaima, you were recently on Kangaroo Island, one of Australia's most well-known wildlife sanctuaries. The wildlife park owner, Sam Mitchell, he was told to evacuate, but he decided to stay to try to defend the animals there. Here's what he told you.
You know, when you see people come running through our doors with a koala wrapped in a blanket with severe burns, and they're hysterical. They want to do everything they can for these animals, but we can't save those that are too far gone.
What was the damage at the conservation park?
Fire came very, very close to them. And he said at one point the wind changed direction and they were spared. However, the island itself has suffered such extensive damage that now there are fears that half of it, about 200,000 acres, have been completely destroyed by the fires. The western part of the island, Flinders Chase, which is home to the national park, and it's one of the most important wildlife havens, not just in Australia, but in the world, because it is home to native species that have lived on the island for centuries. Scientists were telling me it was like traveling back in time because these species were so pure. And now it's been destroyed. Very grave concerns about the future of these species, because either some of them have perished in those fires, or those who've survived, there'll be no food, no water, no shelter for them.
What's been the toll on the people trying to save the animals?
You see people absolutely breaking down in tears. You know, I've spoken to a couple in one of the evacuation centers. They had actually lived on the border of Flinders Chase, so they could see the national park. And when they talk about how beautiful it was, how you could see koalas on trees, and how it just completely turned into black ash from something to nothing, their house was completely destroyed. But they went back to try and save animals. All they were telling me was, all we care about now is the animals.
You've been covering the fires for weeks now. What's the scene after a fire has come through? I mean, how do people begin to rebuild?
Oh, you know, the one thing that actually stays with me every time I go into a scene is the silence. Because you walk into a scene after a fire and it's just dead silent. There is smoke. The earth is still very hot. It's smoldering. It's black. It's ash. There are remains of what used to be a house, but there's nothing there and it's silent. I think the other thing that really stays with me is that without fail, the people who've taken me through these sites of devastation of what used to be their homes, they point to things like they'd say, here's the lounge, here's the pantry that my husband built, this is where we used to hang out and watch television. It's really, really personal.
Shaima, you interviewed wildlife keeper John Marsh at a sanctuary in southeastern Australia. He's angry at the government's response to the fires.
Hopefully, this disaster is going to influence the government to stop just putting development and money before environment and sentient beings.
Shaima, is this something you're hearing a lot of? I mean, are people recovering from the fires making the connection between the government's environmental policies?
Many of them are. There is a big push now for the government to engage in the climate change issue, which is something that they've been reluctant to do. The Prime Minister has addressed it a couple of times. We have yet to see specific plans and specific policies about climate change, which is what everybody's debating now and which the government hasn't provided yet.
Peak fire season in Australia has only just started. Fire conditions are expected to continue for months. How are people coping with that?
There is very little that you can do in the face of a raging fire, especially if it grows to a point where it's uncontrollable or if it joins with another fire. One of the things that one of the firefighters told me when I told him, you know, what are you going to do next? What happens in the next few weeks? He just looks at me and looks in the sky and he says, we pray for rain, because unless we have a substantial change in the weather, unless it rains in a way that will change the situation on the ground, this is just going to continue to happen.
Shaima Khalil is a BBC reporter based in Sydney. Thanks a lot, Shaima.
Great to be with you, Carol.
The World's Carol Hills there. We'll be watching to see if today's rain was enough to make the kind of impact that Shaima was describing. In the meantime, it's hard not to react to images of koalas injured in the fires. But sometimes our desire to help isn't so helpful. Here's the World's Amanda McGowan.
File this next one under well-meaning gestures with unintended consequences. One petition circulating online with about 12,000 signatures has an idea. Why not relocate these koalas to Australia's neighbor, New Zealand? It seems harmless, right? Well, not quite. Andrea Byram is an ecologist in Christchurch. She spoke to the CBC.
I completely understand where people are coming from, but I know from experience and from my personal research that bringing species to other countries and introducing them into places where they haven't been previously is never a good idea.
Byram's concern is that koalas could become an invasive species in New Zealand. That's when a species is introduced to a new place and, faced with no natural predators there, starts to cause big problems for native flora and fauna. In New Zealand, this problem isn't just theoretical. It's very real. Allow this video from the Predator-Free NZ Trust to explain.
We share Aotearoa with some pretty special native wildlife. For millions of years, their only predators were birds, and our only mammals were a couple of bats. But when early settlers introduced animals like rats, possums, and stoats, they put our native species at risk.
Invasive species kill an estimated 25 million native birds every year in New Zealand. That includes birds that can't be found anywhere else in the world, like the iconic flightless kiwi. It's such a big concern that in 2016, then Prime Minister John Key announced a bold new initiative.
By 2050, every single part of New Zealand will be completely free of rats, stoats, and possums.
4 years on, those efforts, using traps and poisonous bait, have found some success. The New Zealand government says over 100 offshore islands are free of pests. But they have a long way to go. So you can imagine why New Zealanders might not be keen on introducing another new species. As for the koalas, Andrea Byram has other ideas.
My personal view is that we should be focusing on rehabilitating systems in Australia and setting up policies and practices that enable Australians to do that. There's been a large amount of habitat lost in Australia, and we should all be worried about that.
And with the fires, those worries are growing exponentially. For the World, I'm Amanda McGowan.
And here's yet another destructive aspect of the fires, social media conspiracies. Tomorrow, how Twitter bots are trying to convince people that arson is causing Australia's unprecedented fires. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Two decades in power and four more years to go. But Russian President Vladimir Putin is looking beyond the end of his current term, perhaps laying the groundwork to keep his grip on power. As we reported yesterday, Putin surprised his own cabinet, along with the rest of the world, when he announced sweeping constitutional changes. The BBC's Moscow correspondent, Steve Rosenberg, looks at how Russians are reacting.
As Moscow woke up this morning, it didn't feel as if much had changed in Russia. The number 38 tram was trundling along as normal, transporting bleary-eyed commuters. The street cleaners were out in force, clearing the slushy pavements. It was only when I went up to my local newspaper kiosk, bought some papers, and looked at the headlines that I was reminded of the drama which unfolded yesterday in Moscow. January Revolution, one paper here is calling it. And yes, what happened did feel revolutionary, something of a political earthquake. Without any warning, the Russian government had resigned en masse, and the Russian president had proposed sweeping constitutional changes. So what exactly is going on? Well, this is about Vladimir Putin and power. In 4 years' time, when his current term ends, he will be constitutionally obliged to leave the presidency. The changes he's proposing appear to give him options for remaining in power after 2024, if not as president, then in a different role, perhaps as head of the Russian State Council or the National Security Council, or as prime minister, or maybe as leader of the ruling party. No one's quite sure which scenario will be selected. Russian MP Vyacheslav Nikonov believes that even without an official position or title, Putin will remain influential.
One way or another, Putin will be an important figure. Even if he'll stay retired in Sochi, he'll still be a very important player in Russian politics, with his office over doubt.
Most of the commuters I speak to, like Yekaterina, claim they'd be happy if Vladimir Putin continues to run the country. He's the best president we've ever had, Yekaterina says. I don't mind eating turnips and grass. Putin is right to spend our money on building up our defences. It is support like this the Kremlin leader will be counting on as he pushes ahead with his plan to change Russia's constitution.
The BBC's Steve Rosenberg reporting there from Moscow. That's something Japan's environment minister is going to hear a lot more of. Shinjiro Koizumi announced he's going to take advantage of his country's generous paternity leave policy after his baby is born later this month. This would make him the highest-ranking Japanese official ever to do so. This is a really big deal there. That's because in Japan, new fathers rarely take time off from work. Koizumi is, but he's not even taking a fraction of his full benefits. He's only taking 2 weeks off, when under Japan's policy, he could take up to a year. Here's the rub. Only 6% of Japanese fathers take any paternity leave at all. Anna Gromada is a social and economic policy consultant for UNICEF. She was the main author of a 2019 UNICEF report on family-friendly policies in high-income countries. As for the announcement from Japan's environment minister, Gromada also believes it's a big deal and an encouraging sign.
Firstly, we are very happy that this is happening. This is good for families. This is good for children. Secondly, out of all high-income countries that we study, only 30 offer any paternity leave, and half of these countries offer 2 weeks of less. So what he's taking is actually the maximum amount that is available in many other high-income countries. What is important also for us is that people in positions of power lead by example. This is important when we have a look at the research about the motives that prevent men from taking paternity leave. If we look at these motives in Japan, the top three reasons have something to do with the employment relationship. People are afraid of the unfavorable atmosphere. People are afraid of their bosses. People are afraid of putting too much burden on their colleagues. Personal motives, such as lower pay, appear only as the fifth main reason why men are not taking the leave. This means that if you are a man in a position of power and other men and women below you would like to do it but cannot because they are afraid of you, once you make this move, you may empower all the people that you manage. That's why we take it as a very positive news.
Even though he's taking 2 weeks of a possible 52-week paternity leave? I mean, is that really leading by example?
What is happening here is a social change. So when we have a look at 1% of take-up that was happening in 2007, this is still a remarkable progress, especially if we remember that what he takes is actually more than what most men take in European countries.
Wow. How long ago did Japan start its generous paternity leave policy, and what was the motivation?
Okay, the first attempts have appeared before 2007. However, then Japan was increasing its length on a regular basis between 2013 and 2019, which means that today it is the country with the single longest paternity leave around the world. It has 52 weeks of paternity leave, paid at, on average, 58%, which is, gives you an equivalent of 30 weeks of full pay.
But it's not necessarily the case that just because you're a rich country, you offer generous paternity leave policies. I mean, Switzerland, Greece, the United Kingdom, they're not doing too well, are they?
Yes, yes. The first is whether you have conditions for doing this, for example, as measured by your GDP. And the second thing is whether there is a political will to do something. So, for example, the US, which is the richest country in history in terms of what it produces in terms of GDP, is the only high-income country that offers nothing in terms of maternity or paternity leave. So clearly, wealth is not a guarantee of a policy. And
well,
by
there,
contrast,
there is the Family and Medical Leave Act of 1993 for maternity leave, but I think that only applies to workplaces of 50 or more employees.
Yes, but what we look at are statutory entitlements. We are perfectly aware of many employers that compensate for the lack of statutory entitlements in the US. However, what is important for us when we choose our indicators is to make sure that it's something which is protected by law. It's something that is not at the grace of your employer to give it to you or to withdraw from you. We consider it to be a right, as also from the child's rights perspective, and we only look at the length that is guaranteed.
So Environment Minister Koizumi will take 2 weeks of paternity leave. You seem to think that's pretty encouraging. What kind of bonding do you think will really happen in 2 weeks between Koizumi and his child?
I'm not in a position to talk about people's private life and his child. Sorry.
Anna Gromada, a social and economic policy consultant for UNICEF. She was the main author of a UNICEF report on family-friendly policies in high-income countries. Thanks for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're with the world. Aliona Aliona, she's now a music phenom in Ukraine, but she started out mimicking what she thought rap was supposed to be.
So I rapped about using drugs and some of the street life that I saw around me, the kind of lifestyle that wasn't really me.
No kidding, she was actually a kindergarten teacher. Aliona Aliona's story and rhymes coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. An American imprisoned in Egypt reached out to President Trump for help. In 2013, Mustafa Kassem was accused of being a spy and taking part in protests against the Egyptian government. After 5 years in pretrial detention, he was sentenced to 15 years in prison. Kassem managed to smuggle a handwritten note out of a maximum security prison in Egypt. "I am putting my life in your hands," the father of two small children wrote to the president. Earlier this week, Kassem died in prison of heart failure. Mohammed Sultan is a human rights activist and head of the Freedom Initiative. He represented Kassem during his case in Egypt. He's a former Egyptian political prisoner himself and joins us from Washington. This is such a tragic story. Could you tell us just a bit first about who Kassem was?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. The first time I laid eyes on him in an Egyptian prison, Tora prison, you know, small frame, big smile, soft-spoken, to himself kind of guy. And, you know, talking to him about how much he loved New York. I hate New York. I hate how busy it is, how much he loved his business. He was an auto parts dealer. And it was just full of life, honestly. And having overlapped with him 4 or 5 months in prison and interacted with him so many times and knowing that he was definitely a bystander, he was at the wrong place at the wrong time, that got picked up simply because he had an American passport. This is not just a Trump problem. This is also an Obama problem. Mm. I was in prison during President Obama's time. Thankfully, President Obama and with Senator McCain and others worked extremely hard to get me out after I was sentenced to life in prison. But unfortunately, we weren't able to extend that same kind of leverage that happened with me and others like Aya Hijazi and others. We weren't able to extend that to Mustafa, and it's heartbreaking.
Aya Hijazi is another American who was in prison but freed.
During the Trump administration, yes.
Well, we know that more recently senior U.S. officials were aware of Qasem's situation, including President Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. In fact, in January 2018, after a visit to Cairo, Vice President Pence said that he spoke with President al-Sisi about Qasem's imprisonment and that Sisi had assured him he would give that very serious attention. So what happened? How does the State Department let something like this happen?
Honestly, I don't know. What I know for sure is myself, Aya Hijazi, Ahmed Atewi, the other American citizen that were freed, we are living testaments of the leverage that the United States government does have with Egypt that we simply chose not to use with Qasem. There is more that needed to be done. There are still 6 American prisoners that are still in Egypt, and we have not used that leverage. And let me say this, the conditions of prison that Mustafa was in, if he were healthy, he still would have been at risk of dying because of the absolute medical neglect.
You were in prison in Egypt for 2 years. I mean, yes. Qasem did end up in a hospital. So you say there's no medical attention, though.
Yeah, I mean, Committee for Justice, a Geneva-based human rights organization, documented 900 deaths in the last couple of years in Egypt due to medical neglect, including the former ousted president. Again, Mustafa was someone who was a diabetic. He had a heart disease. Mustafa he's a cancer survivor. You know, he was already at risk without a hunger strike. But the desperation, I know that because I went on a hunger strike to regain my freedom. The desperation.
Mm. As you say, Mohammed, there are 6 other American nationals still imprisoned in Egypt. The leverage the U.S. has, obviously, is billions of dollars in American aid to the country. Do we know of any efforts to release these prisoners?
I don't know what other efforts are there. We keep advocating for on behalf of not just American citizens, but also Egyptians. There are 60,000 political prisoners in Egypt. Can you imagine how every single one of those people, literally what they have gone to sleep thinking that if the world is going to let an American die on a hunger strike in prison, then they're screwed, that they're toast.
Mohammed, in the 5 months you were in prison with Qasem, is there one memory you keep that, you know, just really kind of captures who he was?
Again, I remember the first time I saw him in an underground dungeon and had bribed my way with guards and soldiers to get to hit the ward that he was. And, you know, I remember laying eyes on him and I remember saying, what the hell is a guy like you doing in a place like this? And, you know, he smiled at me and told me in a very soft voice. He said, well, I'm not a troublemaker like you. And it was so comforting every time we talked because we felt like in this place that we had, we're sleeping on the floor with 18, 19 people in a small room, sharing a hole in the floor as a bathroom, barely getting sunlight, barely getting medical care, and to just have conversations about the places that we've been and the places that we hope to be and to go to. All of those conversations are coming back to me very, very vividly. And I really, really wish we could have had those conversations in New York somewhere over, you know, a burger or something. But, you know, we're hoping that he's in a better place now.
My condolences. Mohammed Sultan is a human rights activist and head of the Freedom Initiative. He's been speaking with us about U.S. national Mustafa Qasem, who has died in prison in Egypt. Mohammed, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Puerto Rico has been dealing with earthquakes for weeks. The biggest was a 6.4 magnitude, but the aftershocks have also been really strong. One of Puerto Rico's largest power plants was damaged, plunging most of the island into widespread blackouts for days. Blackouts are now familiar to Puerto Ricans because the island's grid was so badly damaged after Hurricane Maria in 2017. And since Maria, communities there have created systems to keep the lights on with microgrids. Jose Juan Terraza joins us from San Juan. He's the director of Resilient Power Puerto Rico. Jose, what exactly is a microgrid? What does it look like?
It's essentially an electrical generation and storage system that is independent from the grid itself. It could be solar panels, could be wind. The source of energy really doesn't matter. Here we've been using solar panels to generate electricity and then batteries to store the power. It doesn't matter whether the grid is operating or not. You can rely on your local power.
So after Maria, your organization set up microgrids in over 30 community centers. Why focus on community centers first?
Right after the hurricane, it was very difficult to provide services to the general public because of communication issues, lack of power, transportation. So throughout the islands of Puerto Rico, there are community centers that have been set up by nonprofits, municipal governments, and so forth. And it seemed to be the most efficient way to give power to those centers that provide direct services to the community.
How did those microgrids fare after last week's earthquake?
I think they were impressed. In the 35 installations that we have done throughout Puerto Rico, the centers were able to provide energy after the blackout. And in the two closest to the epicenter in the southwest, in Yauco and in Ponce, the one in Ponce had to be abandoned because the structure itself, the building, was in a precarious condition. But the one in Yauco is able to provide services, and we're actually looking to expand the capacity, the electrical capacity of that system, because of the demand for services.
I'm wondering why the idea of resilient power is so important specifically to the island of Puerto Rico.
We have an electrical system that is still vulnerable to major disruptions. Our work at community centers is trying to have them sufficient power that they can continue to provide services and they can become hubs in their communities to manage any sort of disruption or catastrophe.
How do you define resilience when it comes to power?
The ability to come back after a major disruption or a significant disruption. And also communities' independence in the way that they can manage these situations. So making those systems available not only to community centers but critical facilities. We've been working recently with the critical facilities and what critical facilities are and how to power them is very important so that society can continue and come back after a major storm or an earthquake or whatever it is. But we also don't see these microgrids necessarily as substituting the larger grid. We see them as complementary, as redundancy for these organizations and for society in general. We advocate that these systems be seen as redundant systems that can provide the facility to come back easily, but not necessarily they will supplant or substitute the general grid that we have.
Is the main barrier resources to having this all over the island? Money? Is it simple as that?
Yes. For some institutions and for some organizations, it's financing, the ability to finance these systems. So one of the things that we've been working on is creating financial mechanisms that can be used to spread the solar microgrids across all of the islands.
I'm just curious, how much did last week's earthquakes and the tremors kind of re-energize your project and what you're doing?
I think it brought a different light onto the need for energy resilience because earthquakes, of course, are not predictable. So people don't have earthquakes in their mind. And the earthquakes particularly affect the generation of power at large power plants because they automatically shut off because of the vibrations produced by the earthquakes. In some instances, it's a temporary shutdown, but in other instances where there are damages to transmission lines and to structures, is more a permanent or a longer-term effect.
Jose Juan Terrazo with Resilient Power Puerto Rico and San Juan. Thanks very much and good luck with the project.
Thank you very much.
Britain will formally exit the European Union at the end of this month. That date marks the beginning of a transition period that will last at least until the end of the year. Lawmakers in the EU and Britain hope to hammer out details on trade, law enforcement, data sharing, and countless other issues. Another small piece of the puzzle will be how the UK funds scientific research and how easy or hard it'll be for scientists to work outside of their home countries. The World's Carolyn Beeler reports that Brexit uncertainty is already having an impact.
From his post at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, marine ecologist Lars Bouma noticed the impact of Brexit right away in the summer of 2016.
It started on the day of the referendum, on the morning when the outcome, you can hear that on the news.
The British people have spoken and the answer is we're out.
Voting for a British exit, dubbed Brexit.
Once the largest empire, Britain is an island again.
Colleagues from Europe talked to me. We were at that point writing a proposal for European funding and we decided the best way would be to take me off.
Take his name off the grant proposal. Bouma and his collaborators figured they might not win a competitive European Union grant if a professor from the UK were listed as a lead researcher.
It's our gut feeling that if they think you are out of the EU next year, then they don't want to fund you for the next 5 years.
Bouma wasn't the only one not to apply for that money. If you look at the biggest pot of EU research funding, UK scientists have gotten a smaller share recently. Their funding dropped nearly $500 million from 2015, before the Brexit vote, to 2018. The UK also had fewer EU scientists coming on specific fellowships. And at his university, Bouma saw a drop in applications from potential PhD students from Europe.
In the past, I had maybe half of the applicants coming from the EU. And in the last 2 years, I had no application from the EU. It's a dramatic loss in numbers.
Across the UK, almost a third of academic researchers are from abroad, and half of those come from European Union countries.
So it's a very significant fraction.
That's Venki Ramakrishnan, the president of the Royal Society, Britain's National Academy of Science. He argues that a very international workforce is a good thing for science.
Science should be free-flowing. You know, science depends on the exchange of ideas, on the exchange of people who bring the ideas. And you can see that in the U.S.
Ramakrishnan says American science flourished after World War II when researchers flocked to the U.S. to escape war-ravaged Europe.
That just goes to show you how science is. If you have free-flowing information, free flow of people, that just accelerates science worldwide.
As Brexit becomes a reality, science groups want to keep that flow of people and of money as open as possible. Ramakrishnan is optimistic based on what he's hearing from Boris Johnson's government. In August, the Prime Minister said he would turn the UK into a magnet for scientists from around the world by streamlining immigration policy. Queen Elizabeth made a similar statement in her Queen's speech last month.
A modern, fair, points-based immigration system will welcome skilled workers from across the world to contribute to the United Kingdom's economy, communities, and public services.
So far, Johnson's government has announced an expansion in the number of fellowships that can offer quick visas for visiting scientists. But Ramakrishnan says it's early days still, and he worries about Britain getting a reputation for being unwelcoming.
I'm a non-white American who came to Britain relatively late in life, and there are not many countries that would take someone who's an outsider who can make them the president of their National Academy, which is what the Royal Society is. So in a way, I reflect the traditional openness of Britain and British science. And that is what I hope that a country preserves going forward.
It'll take at least a year to hammer out the details of Brexit, but the ordeal has already had lasting impacts on science. Oceanographer Bastian Kest spent 15 years in Britain, but he just left his research position at the University of East Anglia for a job at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden.
I wasn't originally looking for jobs at this period. I had another 3 years left on my contract.
But then the Brexit vote happened. Kest is French, and he was a little worried about visa issues, but his biggest concern was access to that big pile of European research money.
You know, it's a competitive career, and you move forward by getting papers and getting research grants, and if you don't have the funding opportunities, it's hard to go out there and do good work.
Now that Kest has left England, he says he doesn't see an incentive to bring him back. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
We began the show today in Ukraine, and we closed there as well. Ukraine's been on our minds a lot lately, but those headlines, politics, corruption, impeachment, Ukraine is much more than that, don't you know? So a cultural counterweight is in order. The World's Daniel Hoffman reports from Kyiv.
Once upon a time, in a small village in central Ukraine, there was a girl named Alyona. She had a modest upbringing, but she loved everything about it. She loved the unpaved roads, the cows grazing in the field, and the mushroom picking in the forest. She enjoyed swimming in the lake throughout the summer and ice skating on it during the winter. When Alyona turned 6, she started writing poetry, and when she grew a bit older, she would write pop songs as well. Then, Alyona Savranenka turned 12.
May I have your attention, please?
The first raps I heard were probably American, like Eminem. I started translating his rap and lots of other rappers that I listened to. I was curious what they were rapping about.
He didn't just say what I think he did, did he?
Something clicked with Alyona and hip-hop. She liked that there was more space and freedom to express herself. It was like the poetry she used to write, but without all the rigid rules. As she got older, writing rap lyrics was just part of her life.
I started writing about the things that were happening around me. But, you know, some of it wasn't all true. I really wanted the Ukrainian rap community to accept me, so I rapped about using drugs and some of the street life that I saw around me, the kind of lifestyle that wasn't really me.
She embraced American gangster rap because that's what she thought it was supposed to be all about.
But I wasn't gangster and criminal, I was just teacher in kindergarten. But all the rappers respect for me, yeah, you are cool, you are hot.
Alyona kept her job as a kindergarten teacher, but she also kept rapping and getting more attention. She took on the rap name Alyona Alyona. For a while, she wrote lyrics in Russian because many of the rappers that she listened to were Russian. But then something changed.
My vocabulary in Ukrainian language was bigger and bigger, and I started rapping in Ukrainian language.
She read more Ukrainian literature. She was teaching mostly in Ukrainian. And around the same time, in 2014, Ukraine went through a revolution. People here started feeling a stronger sense of pride in their language, and Alyona felt the same. This song, called Rybki, or simply Fish in English, was Alyona Alyona's first hit. It got more than 2 million views on YouTube. At face value, the song is simply about, well, fish. The way they look, the way they swim. But if you dig deeper, it's really about how powerful fish can be. There may not be anything special about them at first glance, but during a storm, they gracefully swim underwater, while, say, a person on a boat becomes vulnerable.
Most people understood what the song was about, that it's not about fish and water, it's about girls.
Girls and their place in society. Girls who are bullied because they're different. Girls who face abuse for their weight, for their style. Body positivity is a big theme in Alyona's music. This track is called Pushka, which can roughly be translated as the bomb. In it, she calls herself Pishka, a word that's used as an insult for people who are overweight. But Alyona Alyona adopts the word. She makes it her own, and she carries herself with swagger.
Well, it's part of my life. I've encountered a lot of body shaming, fat shaming, and bullying in my life. Now people ask me, how can you be so cool? And I tell them, I'm like everyone else. I just accepted myself the way I am.
And Alyona Alyona hasn't wavered from that positive message. She rarely curses in her music, and that gangster rap style is long gone. One of her recent tracks is all about standing up to bullies.
I saw that Sprite had an anti-bullying campaign and I wanted to work with them. I decided to make a music video where I play different characters like a goth, a basketball player, and others. showing that every person is unique. We shouldn't be afraid to be ourselves, and we shouldn't be afraid to stand strong against bullying.
Check out that video, by the way, at theworld.org. In Ukraine, Alyona Alyona is one of the country's number one artists. She's already toured all across Europe.
So I thank God that I have possibility to introduce my country and my music in European countries, and I will be do this in the future because I don't want to rap in other language. I'm not ready. I don't have so many words to say in English maybe or in Russian. I want to do it in Ukraine.
When I asked Alyona Alyona, she kindly gave me a taste of one of her newest tracks. It's called Kaska. That's the Ukrainian word for fairy tale.
But it's fairy tale not about some heroes. It's about people in Ukraine. Okay. А я все читала дітям довгу казку, як ліпити пастку, як іти не впастися, докупи скласти, жити без баласту, жити просто класно. Отже, я читала дітям просто казку, мов ліпила паску до життя, як пазли, і воно смугасте. Люди носять маски, а слова як пластир, пластир до рани. В планах сіяти любов, діти ніби провідник, усе тепло йде від них. Ей, плавно споглядали дані, вчили золоті рядки, щоб знали діти стати ким. Я бачу коло із осіб, що дітям бруд ховають хліба, все дитяче.
Wow, skills for real. Alyona Alyona's track, Kazka, or Fairy Tale there, that came to us from the world's Daniel Offman.
Знають, певно, хто є ти, без примарних павутиль, між порожніх та пустих, просять неба відпустити дощ.
More cultural counterweights tomorrow will meet singer-songwriter J.S. Ondara. He got to the U.S. by chance. He won the State Department's annual green card lottery.
You know, it was extremely surreal. Before that, I'd spent a couple of years really trying to find a way to get here. And, you know, I did all kinds of things. I applied for work, I applied for schools, and I wanted to come here and make music.
Now J.S. Ondara is nominated for his first Grammy.
He was just an American dream. He was just an American dream. Yeah, yeah.
My conversation with Kenyan singer-songwriter J.S. Ondara tomorrow, right here on The World. Until then, from the Nana Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being here.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.